Greetings, film freaks. We are the Podcorn Kernels. Join us as we discuss the hard and often indigestible truths that are at the center of the fluffy and delicious world of cinema. Season 2.
What's popping, people? Welcome to the Podcorn Kernels podcast. My name is Adam, and joining me in your ear holes is Harry. Say hello, Harry.
Dude, I cannot believe that Barbie is your favourite film for the Oscars. You're fucking mad.
On today's episode, we will be talking about Saltburn. This is a 2023 film directed by Emerald Fennell and stars Barry Keoghan, Jacob Elordi and Rosamund Pike. IMDb describes the synopsis as follows. A student at Oxford University finds himself drawn into the world of a charming and aristocratic classmate who invites him to his eccentric family's sprawling estate for a summer never to be forgotten. Here is an original song to support the synopsis.
F-E-L-I-X-O, yes. F-E-L-I-X-O, yes. F-E-L-I-X-O, yes. F-E-L-I-X-O, yes. Roses are red and violets are blue. I'll slip your bathwater and fuck your grave too. So yes. F-E-L-I-X-O, yes. I will be quick to suck on your blood. I am so sick. My dick's in the mud.
Let's start with some facts about the film. Barry Keoghan spent a Belfast weekend with filmmaker Michael McNulty developing his Liverpool accent and drinking pints for 20 hours straight.
Who's Michael McNulty?
I don't know. I'm more focused on the fact that he sat and drank with a Liverpudlian for 20 hours straight.
That's pretty insane.
I'm not always a fan of method acting, but if part of the process is sitting in a cosy pub and drinking for 20 hours, I'm kind of behind it. I don't think I could manage 20 hours in a pub.
20 hours?
10? A gentleman's 10, yes. Slow day drink I could do, but 20 hours?
Keoghan's, he's not exactly a big man. No. Like, you can understand when you get those big, heavy set 18-stone scaffolders putting away 10 pints.
Yeah.
10's an achievement.
I think if I'm on a day drinking with you and at the end I'm like debating whether that's pint 9 or pint 10, I'm thinking to myself, they are good innings.
Yes.
Done well there. But yeah. I love a drink with you, one of my favourite things to do. Could I go 20 hours? I don't think so.
How is this related to Saltburn again, sorry?
Well, he spent 20 hours drinking with someone who I'm assuming is from Liverpool to develop his Liverpool accent. Sounds to me like a great excuse to go and get pissed.
I wouldn't say he has the stereotypical Liverpudlian accent.
Yeah, I'm a fan of Barry. I big up Barry a lot. I can't sit here and say that he did a flawless Liverpudlian accent, well, in my opinion.
It depends. That's usually in a city where you get the, don't be shy, love, pull down me bockies. But if you... the surrounding area of Liverpool can have some extremely posh areas and it's a lot less harsh.
So more muted Liverpudlian.
Yeah. It's like if you go to South London, the Millwall area on a Saturday, the voices you're going to hear are vastly different to one you're hearing in West London.
Yeah, of course.
Vastly different.
Yeah. I just, again, that's just a fact that,
excited you. Excited you. That's fun. That's good times.
Yeah. I mean, the longevity of it, I can't wrap my head around, but I'm here for long drinking sessions.
Are you trying to lean me towards potentially going for a beer.
I'm saying I want you to be the McNulty to my Keoghan. And I'm just saying one day we could try and do 20 hours straight. I mean, yes, chances are very high that an ambulance would need to be called within the like 19th, 20th hour. But if you don't try, you never know.
But you also have to find a bar that's going to let you go beyond the 12-hour mark.
That is true.
The 12 till 12. Then we'd have to be in a club or something, and that is hell on earth.
Yeah, fuck ever stepping foot into a sticky floored club again.
Oh, wolfhound dog cat.
Bah. Emerald Fennell stated she considers Saltburn a vampire movie, even though the story does not have supernatural elements.
God.
There is a nod to this when Oliver refers to himself as a vampire. Stretching, innit?
Very stretching, because if anything, you don't even have to jump to mysticism. You could just say parasitic.
Mm.
You can talk about a bacteria. You could talk about a virus overtaking your good cells. It doesn't need to jump to vampirism.
Yeah.
Just because he had some monthlies on his mouth. That makes no sense to me whatsoever. I think she thinks it's smarter than it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's not. I'm not saying it's a bad film. I'm just saying I think it's been written in a way where it's for the Gen Zs to lap up. It's a fad.
For me, it just reeks of someone saying that, oh, look, you know, he could be a vampire, and her latching onto that is convenient, I think. Like, I don't think she ever wrote this. I mean, this is just personal opinion. I don't think she wrote this and go, oh, he's actually a vampire.
Well, it's
ridiculous. If that was the case, you would have made more considered choices, like he would never be out in the daytime or something like that.
That's what I mean. What are the famous tenets of a vampire?
Well, they can't go out in sunlight. Don't like garlic. Don't like wood in their chest.
Hate wood in their chest. Can't eat anything other than blood.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he didn't eat the eggs, but I saw him eat other stuff.
Yeah. Boozed. You see him booze. Yeah, he boozes. You don't see him eat, actually. No, you do. At dinner, he's munching on some pie and saying, this is a lovely pie.
Yeah.
Had the cake. So, yeah. It feels to me that someone out there said, oh, you know what? This film that's like become really popular really fast, Oliver could be a vampire.
Yeah, I think she used the wrong vernacular. That was just, it doesn't track. She should have just said parasite. But then I suppose she doesn't want her film to be compared to Parasite, because that's exactly the same.
Mm.
It's one person infiltrating a house to eventually take it over.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what happens in Parasite.
Yeah, is parasitical is the perfect term to use, because that's what he does.
Yep.
He gets into their life and tries to take it over. So, yeah, the vampire is a stretch, as I say.
Mm.
The actual place used for Saltburn is Drayton House, Lowick, Kettering, UK. It was built around 1300. Now, that fact I included because I know you love a bit of history, and I wouldn't be surprised if you could tell me about England around the 1300 mark. But you told me people are actually breaking into this house because of the frenzy created by this film.
Yeah.
Which is a madness.
Yeah, the people that actually own the estate, it's a lived-in property. I think when they were filming, Rosamund Pike actually stayed there, read books on the grounds and stuff. She even said her actual character would never have read a book, because she's obviously quite a bit of a disgusting human, really. But it's in Northamptonshire, and yeah, so little TikToker bitches are jumping over the fences and getting photos near the pool and stuff because it's a fad film, right?
Yeah.
It's like when Quadrophenia came out in the UK, there's a famous alleyway in Brighton where they filmed a shot where they have sex in an alleyway. And you can go to the alleyway and it's got graffiti of like people visiting it, millions of people all around the world because it's a cult following. So that property is going to have that for a year or two, isn't it? Fad's definitely the word I see, because you don't walk away from the film, I don't believe, without the most visceral moments being what you remember.
Of course, yeah.
And it's made in that. It's made in that way.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It seems to be we're at like the conception of this cultural phenomenon that's like meant for a generation that's younger than you and I, and it feels akin to like The Matrix when people would wear the long leather trench coat. Something happens within the film, so they start acting like or visiting these places. The difference is we live in a time where everyone's got a phone and where like it reels and stuff spread like wildfire. So the song that's at the end of the film is now just fucking everywhere, because we live in a time that everyone's got access to have a platform where they can sort of feed off like a parasite on a film like Saltburn. It is fucking everywhere. And you're right, it does it for me. It's not going to leave a cultural footprint that is going to be looked at, say, like the likes of Fight Club or Quadrophenia, Matrix, these huge moments in cinematic history that have left an impact. This one, for me, doesn't have enough substance to be long-lasting.
Well, your mention of this song proves the point that this is a young person's cult film, because for Sophie Ellis-Bextor to all of a sudden be in the charts again means that it comes from people that never knew the song.
Yeah.
Just like Stranger Things are running up their hill, Kate Bush. They're popular again because of the young crowd
discovering it.
Because they're being visually stimulated. The song that now plays whilst being visually stimulated, to them now it's good.
Mm.
Whereas if they heard that on a radio and they didn't have the visual stimulation, they wouldn't like it.
Yeah, well, it's hard to, if you can't pair it with something that they've enjoyed. And listen, if I was a young 16 to 19 year old and my film knowledge isn't what it is now, and I'd just recently got into films and only watching current films, I honestly think I'd probably really enjoy this film. If I was the right age and watched this, I would be like, wow, Saltburn's amazing. It's so edgy. It's so dark. Problem is, I've seen better films do more interesting things with dark characters a lot younger. So I'm longer in the tooth. And watching this film, it's easy for me to compare to those films that I mentioned, like American Psycho, that focuses on a sociopath that does all these things. Problem is, being mid to late 30s, this pales in comparison to those films. But for a younger audience that don't have that repertoire to compare it to, I can kind of see why it's become so popular.
But it also has Elordi in it, good-looking, upcoming model actor.
He ticks all the boxes, doesn't he?
I mean, you could even read about it online. Like, obviously, we get reprimanded constantly if we objectify, say, women. So if there's an actor and we go, gosh, she's so good looking, it's like, why don't you focus on her work? There are millions of columns on lots of women magazines where they're just talking about his looks. Yeah. Nothing to do with his performances.
Yeah.
So he gets objectified. Mm. Very different to us. So he's eye candy. So boom, you've got that.
Yes.
Then you've got, like, I can see it now. I can imagine if I was at school now and I was 15, 16 and I'd managed to see it, you'd all be talking about it.
Of course you would, yeah.
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 And it would be that thing. It would be like when you first see American Pie and he sticks his dick in a pie.
Yeah. You go home and you go and fuck a pie.
Yeah. And for years you think it's a great film.
And then when you've got some experience behind you, you watch that film back and you're like, my God, I used to love this.
What, experience in pie fucking?
Yeah. And then you know that pie don't hit like it did when you were fucking it when you were 16. When you're fucking it as a 37-year-old man, you're just crying.
Just cry, especially when you're gluten intolerant. Can you still get the badness from gluten if it goes in your eye?
I haven't yet, and I'm a cereal pie fucker, so I haven't yet. No,
pastry penis.
Yeah. What did you like about Saltburn?
Oh, one of the things that stood out definitely early in the first act was, it's like, this film's like a summer I did not spend somewhere, but I knew the summer. I knew what it was.
Yeah.
It felt like deja vu for me. Early scenes where you see Oliver and Felix really hit home when there's a montage of them drinking in the summer in, like, Cambridge.
Yeah.
And I really, like, knew them days, because it's set in 2006. I think our summer of descent was, like, what, 2008?
Yeah. I mean, when this film's set, we would be around about the same sort of age as the characters in this film.
Well, Superbad was out.
Yeah.
The music was there. I think, and then they play Mr. Blindside in this, the killers. Yeah. And it cost a fortune to get the rights to have it in the film, but it was only played for a very short time in the truck. But yeah, it was like having a little, it was like having a flashback to, like, something I never actually took part in.
Yeah. I know what you mean. It's that timestamp, isn't it? You recognise the music, you recognise those summer, those carefree times where you could go out and get drunk till 3 o'clock in the morning and then still turn up for work at a supermarket at 7 a.m. Yeah. feeling fine. It was those simpler times.
Felt like you were living. Enough. Life wasn't too serious yet.
Exactly that.
And this happens in the first act. And that's the problem with a lot of films nowadays. The opening is always the best for a majority of the films I watch, especially for this. I found the opening was intriguing.
Yeah.
You don't quite know the deviousness yet of Quick.
Yeah.
The way it implies that the rich in this are the bad ones.
Mm.
And then you realise, obviously, by the end, it's not the case.
Exactly,
He's infiltrated them like a parasite. I accidentally fingered my cousin there
when he says that. I'm like, let's explore that some more.
Yeah. I'm not interested in Oliver potentially being a vampire. I want to know what events led up to him fingering his cars.
I was like, well, you can't just drop that. You walk in when he first introduced him to the Saltburn house. You can't just drop that.
Yeah.
You can't just say, I accidentally fingered my cousin there. Hey, where's the how's it an accident?
Yeah.
What position was she in? And how did you slip to accidentally slide one in?
Yeah. Or is it like you didn't know she was your cousin until the finger got wet?
Then again, yeah, it could be true because of the masked parties that they seem to have.
Yeah.
Very, very baroque.
Yeah, very eyes wide shut.
Very, very creepy. Yeah, that made me laugh. I thought that was quite a funny little insight. Bit odd, incestuous. Mm. I thought Pamela and Rosamund Pike in their opening scene, Pamela's played by Carey Mulligan, I thought they could be the next absolutely fabulous. Such a comedic duo.
That is a great shout.
They were brilliant.
Oh, man. I mean, it could be a completely different program, like new characters, but them in that same sort of dynamic would be amazing.
Because Pamela was like Joanna, is it Joanna Lumley?
Yeah.
The blonde one.
Yeah, yeah.
Really drunk almost, constantly. Yeah. She appeared drunk. And Rosman's like the observer, the one who critiques everything. I thought it was really funny. The very small part Carey Mulligan had in this, but apparently she requested to be in it.
Yeah, she worked with Emerald Fennell on her first
Promising
Young Woman, yeah.
And Bo Burnham's in that, you said?
Yeah.
That's mad.
Yeah.
That's so strange.
Yeah, I mean, she's done two films now, and I'm probably in the minority where I consider Promising Young Woman miles, miles better than Saltburn.
Okay.
But like we said, like right at the start of this episode, this is a cultural phenomenon that's right at its infancy. People are loving it, and I'm not going to lie, that's why I picked it to do a podcast episode on, because it's so current, it's so hot right now, and you know, you kind of feel like you have to talk about it. But in comparatively, Saltburn with Promising Young Woman's head and shoulders above it for me anyway. It explores a lot more. It's a lot more interesting. Yeah,
I haven't seen it. I liked that the only technical trait between what the privileged see as their like superiority over the plebs is that they're born with money. Because they've got all the ugly traits that they consider the poor people to have.
Mm.
It's really strange, actually. It's kind of an oxymoron in itself, this film, because the posh in this have almost all got tattoos, or their hair's dyed, or they're drinking a lot, they're shagging a lot. They're like no different. The only difference is that they were born to money. That's how Emerald Fennell's written it and made it look. I don't think it's realistic.
Yeah, it's almost punk rock privilege, isn't it?
It doesn't really make sense because... This is going to sound really weird, but for me, I feel like posh people look beyond things like tattoos, because tattoos are a tribal thing, which are associated with the lower class.
Mm.
I've got tattoos.
Yeah.
Like, but in my mind, like Pamela having tattoos, Felix having tattoos, the sister having tattoos. I think even Rosamund Pike might have had one on her arm.
Maybe, yeah.
And I just found it very odd. I'm like, you're snobs, you're rich, you're privileged. I don't imagine a world where you're drinking constantly, you're doing blow and you're covered in tattoos. I don't know. It seems, I'd like to see if there's a real case study of any real families like that.
Yeah, especially when the family still stick with the traditions of serving your own breakfast, having house staff, all of these really sort of outdated traditional values and stuff like that, that they're open to having tattoos. Because you're right, you don't necessarily associate tattoos with upper class. Like it's
maybe one tearaway black sheep of the family.
Yeah.
But I mean, it seemed quite consistent in this.
Yeah, they did. It was like rock star, like privilege sort of thing.
And one of the girls that Felix sleeps with in Oxford, sorry. Is it Oxford?
I think it's Oxford, yeah.
Yeah, one of the girls he sleeps with, there's a couple. They look no different from the girls that I would have seen out in Sutton, South London in 2006 and 2007. They didn't have any classy clothes on. Their makeup was all was you know, a bit loud for the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were saying like, oh, we don't want Oliver to come because he's wearing Oxfam clothes. And I'm like, but look at you. You're not exactly the pinnacle of class.
Yeah.
So I found it weird. I found the language of some of the characters, that over the top British Elizabethan pronunciations of things whilst looking trash.
Yeah.
It was weird. I don't know if it's semi-biographical, because Fennell herself went to Greyfriars, Oxford. Her dad was a jewellery designer. So she herself comes from privilege.
certain.
And I don't say privilege as in it's a diss.
No,
of course. You cannot help. You cannot help where you're born.
Yeah.
It's not even jealousy. It's like, it's a way of categorizing. Born in privilege, born in poverty. Like this, I'm just categorizing. I'm not saying I think less of her because she's privileged.
No, of course not. And I do wonder how much of this is almost biographical because, you know, she would be, I think she's a similar age as us. So she would be at that age at that time. The film represents the time when she would have been at Oxford and studying and that party life, all of that. So she must be pulling on some level of experience and on some moments that happened in her life to make the film.
Mm.
But that is an interesting point, a kind of oxymoron that these are really privileged people with house staff and that, but they almost lead this like rock and roll lifestyle. And these people that are fortunate enough to get the highest education in Oxford are, like you say, you'd see them out in a nightclub in areas that we used to go out drinking. There's no differentiation between how we experienced young life and how they experienced. When you think from that this side of the fence, that they would have a lot more of an enhanced experience because of their privilege, because of what they've come from.
That's why I don't know how realistic it is, because to me that is diametrically opposed. It doesn't look right.
It is an odd one. Like there's a lot of, like you say, there's lots of elements of this that reminded me of my youth. Like I could taste it, the Mr. Brightside being played. Like that was a big tune when I used to go out to nightclubs. That sort of sense of excitement of just going out and not knowing where you're going to end up and what time you're going to get home. The freedom to do all of that, the lack of responsibility. That's something I certainly tapped into as well.
Mm.
Are you done with your like? Shall I go on to mine?
Yeah.
Saltburn is edgy and engaging, eat the rich entertainment. I found Emerald Fennell's sophomore film to be funny, feral and fucking dark. Now, I know you might disagree with me, but I think she's a director with a bright future, and I'm impressed that she has already managed to establish herself in the world of dark comedy. Saltburn is a riotous ride of parasitical power grabbing, and I, for one, enjoy films that have an unhinged sociopath leading the line. Now, you made me realise something recently on doing this very podcast. You said that I'm into anarchy, and it's a point that I've never really thought about, but it tracks.
Yeah.
Some of my favourite films, the leads are sociopaths. The leads are broken people, people trying to push past fractured psyche, all these things. And at its core, the film focuses on kind of an antagonist, an anti-hero. He's not a good guy. He's doing evil dealings. And for me, that ticks a box straight away, because I just don't know, there's something about me that enjoys this sort of brand of film.
Mm.
Like I say, compared to our first one, her first outing, this does pale in comparison. But
maybe it's a classist thing.
Reckon?
Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with sometimes feeding yourself with a little gratification that potentially, just because you're rich, you might not be happy. Like, it's nice to think that when you've got all the success in the world and you don't have to want for anything, that you could still be unhappy, because then it makes you reassures yourself, because in your mind, let's say you're struggling, let's say whatever, your life's gone down and you feel like, fuck, you know, I wish I had the opportunities these people have. When you find out that it's not perfect for them either,
yeah,
it's just sort of a relief. It's sort of like, well, do you know what, what's the point in working hard to try and achieve all these things if I'm still going to be unhappy?
It humanizes. Robin Williams. Yeah, it's exactly that, isn't it? You always think the grass is greener on the other side, and it's cliche, of course it is. But you see, money doesn't guarantee happiness. I mean, it can help. I mean, if you've got the means to go and do what you want when you want, I'd say, and this from someone that doesn't have that luxury, I'd say, well, it would be a bit better. I can go and do whatever I want whenever I want.
Of course, yeah.
But then equally, someone that's got that taste of a luxurious lifestyle, they might yearn for a simpler time, might yearn for having to work for stuff rather than it be so readily available. And listen, there's far better films than this out there that explores class and privilege and wealth and struggle and all of these things. For me, this is nothing more than a throwaway pulp film that's entertaining. People are trying to make out this cultural landmark that's going to withstand the test of time and is this massive, massive masterpiece. I completely disagree, but for what it is, I was enjoyed during. I did enjoy watching it. I enjoyed my time with it.
Yeah,
I don't. I get a sense you maybe not so much, but we'll get onto that when we delve into your dislikes.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I also like Barry Keoghan. As I said before, I'm a fan of Barry. I think he's at his best when he's playing a fucking menace, and his character Felix is the summit of shifty. He doesn't play Felix, he plays Oliver. I fucked up in a write-up there, didn't I?
First time ever, don't ask me why, struggling with the names.
Yeah.
Struggling, and I watched this almost twice.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden, all the names left my head.
It happens. I've got it written down wrong. What does that say about me?
Yeah. Couldn't have been memorable.
No. I've been a big fan of Barry for a while, and despite some dodgy accent dips, I thought he was brilliant as a deeply troubled individual who goes from this sort of outcast to opportunist to mass manipulator. Now, he's in a lot of things recently. He's really hot property right now.
Vogue.
Yeah, he's everywhere. You can't move without bumping into Barry on social media or anything.
Just because he got his dick out.
Yeah, I mean, I look at him in this and I look at him in Banshees of Inisherin. It's worlds apart. And I did enjoy his performance in this, but he's done a lot better things. It's just, it's that
This is his
trend.
First lead, isn't it?
I suppose it must be. Out and out lead.
He might be.
He's done.
He's co-lead in Killing the Sacred Deer.
And Calm with Horses.
He's co-lead.
Kind of co-lead, yeah.
Because
yeah,
Cosmo Jarvis would lead in that one, really.
I think you're right. I certainly can't think of anything where he's been head honcho. But I still, I mean, the more he does, the more I see of him, it does start to feel like he's sort of pigeonholed himself into this sort of role. And he's the same mannerisms and characteristics and movements he does are very similar throughout each role he's in. But I still like him. There's still enough about him, charisma-wise, talent-wise, that I'm still intrigued.
I think he's a good actor. I think he's always had weird accents, even when he's doing his own accent.
Yeah,
it's weird. Either he watched a lot of American films and he's got some sort of twang to it, but even in Banshees, sometimes sounds a little American.
Yeah, he's got that sort of nomad quality.
Dunkirk, he had a really wavering voice.
Yeah, I knowing we were doing an episode on Saltburn today, I revisited The Killing of a Sacred Deer, where he's good 10, maybe even 15 years younger than he
exactly
is.
Exactly the same
now.
Film, isn't it?
It's kind of the same character, and puts on an American accent in that. And I did watch that and I was like, his accent in that does wave a lot. And you're right. It's like that Charlie Hunnam actor as well. Mm. Like, you know, he's a Geordie, he's from Newcastle, but he's done so many different roles, been all over the place for so long. You can't pinpoint his accent.
Yeah.
And I think Keoghan's going that way as well.
Essentially, I didn't notice any big issues of the accent he had in this. Just that obviously it weren't Irish, but other than that, it's that sort of obscure area between Liverpool, Leicester and Manchester where you couldn't really define it. I couldn't.
No. I also really enjoyed the rest of the cast. I've already bigged up Barry, but I also think everyone else was brilliant too. I thought Jacob Elordi as well-intentioned Toff was terrific. I loved Richard E. Grant and Rosamund Pike as the privileged parents.
With Northern Ireland.
Yeah, and thought Archie Madekwe, Ewan Mitchell and Alison Oliver all did well in making the most out of smaller supporting roles.
Why are you making up names?
I'm not. I hope I've got those
Just
ones
right. Throwing
names
out there, man.
I hope I've got those names right. Yeah. But the supporting cast, like we spoke about it after you first watched the film, and you said about Ewan Mitchell having this really small role within the film. He was brilliant. I would love to have seen more of him in like a villainous role.
I thought he was going to be prominent within this film.
Yeah.
He's in the trailer.
Yeah. His character's so menacing and like there's something unhinged about him as well as Oliver Quick, Barry Keoghan's character.
I honestly thought this was going to be a tug of war between Mitchell and Elordi, with Keoghan in the middle being spit roasted by their personalities.
Mm.
That's what I thought. And then he's just gone.
Yeah, I found that strange. I found that was almost a waste of talent. Like, he was really striking. He's in one of the first scenes and he loses his rag about for asking Oliver to give him a math son. And then he, like, even the way he eats a chocolate bar like a fucking psychopath.
Just screams.
Yeah.
He's exceptional in Last Kingdom and House of Dragon.
Yeah.
He's going to be great. He's going to be really good. He's got a jaw of a Saxon.
Yeah, he does, yeah.
How are
you? Yeah, you cut cheese off that dog.
Yeah.
What didn't you like about Saltburn? I feel as there's going to be a fuse.
The butler of Saltburn is an extension of his lord and lady. So he would never show animosity or disapproval towards his employer's guests. No matter how low in the food chain they are, his obvious like animosity from the outset is unrealistic. Mm. So Keoghan turning up, he doesn't know anything about this guy apart from that he's the lady's son, has called him a friend and he's invited Oliver to come here.
Yeah.
I thought that was another exaggeration and a stab at entitlement. There's no way on earth a butler, he's an extension of his lady and lord. He would treat that person like they are the lady and lord.
Mm.
That's the idea behind
yeah.
that sort of world.
That dynamic,
having you know, footmen and stuff. So I found it very odd from the get-go. He's instantly quite dismissive of Oliver. This is before you even realise Oliver's psychotic sociopath narcissist. So I found that to be unrealistic. No one turned down the television that was showing Superbad, and we can no longer hear it either. But E. Grant is smiling at the TV, watching it and laughing, but there's no subtitles on the screen. So if I was Fennel, I would have showed Grant, use a remote when Oliver comes in the room where they're slagging him off and they start to talk, to at least put it on mute. And then when you see Superbad again in the back frame, it should have had subtitles in it. E. Grant, he's like a madman. He's sitting there going, and nothing, you can't hear anything.
Yeah.
So the TV magically turns down for the on-set dialogue. And I think if you're a director, you should pick up on shit like that.
That's an error that shouldn't be made by a professional filmmaker, really, should it? It's those minor details that maybe the editor should have picked up on, or someone should have picked up and been like, well, we would hear this.
It's an easy one. It's a very easy one.
Yeah.
Don't let it happen. Don't do it again. Next one, this made me laugh. So one of the things, I'm quoting Rosamund Pike here on an interview of Deadline, but one of the things Emerald said when Elspeth discovers Felix dead in the maze was, I'll never show that. You can never see a mother's grief on film. It's just too awful. It's too much. So by the time we hear Elspeth, and by the time the others come in, she's already battened down the hatches and buried the feelings, immediately overridden it and suppressed it. But that doesn't mean I didn't have to play it off screen. Hold on, Emerald. Cummy bathwater, period blood in mouth of shipper and consignee, and almost necrophilia upon the grave. Pick a lane. Can't show the grief of a mother's death on a screen.
Yeah.
But you'll show the sharing of period blood between two mouths, cummy bath, and a guy fucking a grave.
Yeah, that's fine. We can't see a emotionally stunted woman lose her head in the most fiercest moment of grief you could imagine. For me, that would have been the perfect opportune moment to show this almost robotic woman who's privileged and is almost living a fairy tale land, to humanize her, to show her like she's at heart a real person that really feels. Surely that's the moment you sort of show to your audience, look, she's just like everyone else.
Yeah, I almost said it when you mentioned the vampire comment, because some of this stuff don't track for me. And I find it's almost like she's writing the reasons for things after doing them, rather than doing them because of a reason.
I completely agree with you there. She's quite outspoken about this film. And if a director's at the helm of a film that suddenly skyrockets in popularity, they're going to be asked a lot of questions because it's such a hot topic. Everybody wants to know why they did it, how they did it, all of this. So it feels like after the fact this film was made, she's jumping on conveniences and excuses. And it's like, oh yeah, no, that's why it's this. Yeah, yeah. I heard someone on TikTok say it's because of this, because they love the film. Yep, that's the reason. For me, I do tend to agree with you. Now, this is coming from someone who does appreciate what Fennell's doing in her own little world of directing. Like, there's certain parts of Saltburn that really did work for me. And as I said, Promising Young Woman's a lot better film. For me, I'm excited to see what she does, because she's like Jordan Peele's doing with the horror genre. She's doing something similar from a female perspective with dark comedy. And that's exciting to me.
I think she cheapened it with the killings. I think this could have been as gripping, as terrifying without any of the death. So when Felix even says to Oliver, you make my fucking blood feel cold, it could have stayed like that and everyone could have lived and it still could have been a creepy film. That last 20, 30 minutes, it became a cheap M. Night Shyamalan twist film.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh.
Yeah. I mean, that could be a result of our experience with films, just knowing it's coming to that conclusion. And I'll go into that a bit more with my final dislike.
Can I interrupt? I just went, because just off the back of that, before you move into another one, but it was two of Farley's scenes in it were written in a week before filming them. So when Keoghan gets in the bedroom with him and gives him a handy shandy, that was written in. And then the one where Farley reveals himself at the party with the horse head was written in like a week before, because they realised that you have to give justification as to why Farley's showing animosity towards him from the start.
Yeah.
So it had to be written in.
Yeah.
Because in the original treatment script, it weren't.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So I don't know. I see flaws.
Yeah.
I see a lot of flaws in... I love how I refuse to call her Fennel and you refuse to call her Fennel.
But that covers all bases, because I actually don't have a fucking clue how to say
it. No, they can be the only two.
I like to add some flourish on it. If my surname was a vegetable, I'd rather be called Fennel than Fennel.
But I would look at the etymology of it. I would look at why did they call her Emerald? Yeah. Because it sounds like fennel, emerald fennel.
Jewelry vegetable.
Whereas if it's Fennel and they called it Emerald Fennel, I just feel like it's fennel.
Okay. Well, when she comes on the podcast, we can ask her, can't we?
Well, the first money we make, we should hire a linguist. And every time one of us gets a word wrong, they do a buzzer and they tell us the word and then we restart the sentence again.
So we have a full-time person there that's there. Their whole purpose is to buzz in when we get something wrong.
In a tennis referee chair.
I'd love it.
Yeah.
I mean, they would have to have long-lasting batteries because the amount of mistakes we make, they'd be buzzing all the time, right? Any more dislikes for thee?
No, that's good. I don't want to hit on it too hard.
No? You can. Don't be scared.
Inconsistencies.
Bro.
I believe it was written for Gen Z fad. It's a fad film.
Yeah.
There's elements I did enjoy.
Yeah.
But it for me, because it became trash at the end for me.
Yeah. I tend to agree. If I was to just do a quick summary, it had me in the palm of its hand for the first two acts, and then how it concludes, I was sort of being like, You missed the boat there.
It's a dark comedy, isn't it? But it's weird. It's laced with inconsistencies for me.
I do think if you and I were sitting here as 18-year-old podcasters, I think we'd be having very different views and opinions. And
I don't think we'd be sitting here.
No, nor do I. We'd be probably drunk somewhere already. But I do see and appreciate and understand that we aren't necessarily the target audience. But I do think it's worth we're grown, we're not old. It is worth giving our sixth sense, our opinion on it, because it's going to differ from those that absolutely adore it. Mm. Now, it's overwhelming the sort of amount of time and just consideration this film is getting on social media. And that's coming from someone, I'm not on social media all the time. I go on it to plug this podcast. But every day, if I'm scrolling through reels or looking at other people's film accounts on Instagram or any of the social media sites, Saltburn's there and it's still there. And this came out before Christmas. Mm. It just seems to be this huge behemoth of a cultural phenomenon at the moment. And I just think when people get older and this film gets older, it's going to be one of those films that people look back and go, it ain't that good. It was just shock cinema. That's all it will be remembered for.
That's what annoys me, because there are films that can do it. Dogtooth, Skin I Live In, these are films that have similar odd sort of dark comedy elements to them, but also speak to a lot of other things. Vanity and ego and control. And they're done in my opinion, a much cleverer way.
Yeah.
Cleverer word? Cleverer?
Yeah. Can be.
Ding.
Yeah, there's that buzzer. I'll go into what I dislike. And bathtub seed feed, midnight monthly munch, and grieving ground pound. There are three scenes in this film that made me feel like a prude man. And you know what the scenes are. Everybody knows what the fucking scenes are.
I didn't want to talk about them.
No, I know, but I do. The first, involving bath time, man milk, and slurping dirty water, honestly made me feel like I was going to vomit. The second, featuring bloody finger and menstrual digestion, made me evaluate if I would be open to vaginal vampirism.
Oh.
News Justin, I would not. And the third, grief fucking deceased dirt. Each scene felt like a curated collection of shock for shock's sake cinema that actually did nothing other than make me feel like I am too old to find value in such debauchery.
That's a soundbite, isn't it?
I mean, so. Because
I think it is.
I think watching this film, it's one of those films that makes me feel older than I am, because a younger Adam would have watched this and gone, oh, this film is dirt. Look at all these scenes. Oh, this is shocking. This is dirt. Yeah. But I watch it now and I'm like, is that needed, darling? Do I really need to see him eat blood? Do I need to see him drink bath water? Doesn't matter that there's man milk in the bath water. The fact that that's hot, dirty water of someone else and he swallows it makes my stomach churn.
It's inconsistent as well, because the bath water doesn't progress the story. It doesn't actually progress Oliver's intentions. His intention is to overthrow the family and make it look like there's a suicide. The bloody fingers and stuff, I don't know if it progresses him as devious.
It's just, it sort of cements that he's questionable, but you don't need that. You don't need that stuff. Like, to be that obsessed that he gurgles cum water.
Does he just use sex as a tool, as a weapon?
I think so. I think he's seen as these richer deemed superior people, with he's got some currency within that household with his sexuality. Like, he's tickling the pickles of all sorts in that house. And ironically, the only person that is not interested whatsoever is Felix, the one that he's supposedly obsessed with.
Well, he's not gay. You can't just make someone gay because you fancy them.
Yeah. And those scenes, just like you said, the inconsistencies, is like, and the fact that you're right, it doesn't push the story forward. If he was doing all these dodgy dealings because for any reason other than to shock the audience, I'd be like, okay, this was there because of this. For me, it was just like the talking points. That's what you watch this film. It's like the iceberg in Titanic. You know, it's going to happen. That's what you're going to talk about. In this film, you only need to, I mean, I watched this film before you. You didn't watch it and you already knew what happened because it was everywhere. It's those three scenes is what everyone's talking about. It's become popular culture already.
It's like a full structure. If that's what you're hearing, then that becomes the essence of the film. And it's like, well,
I mean, I've seen more impactful, more shocking scenes in cinema. For me, it did make my skin crawl. I was like, particularly the bathwater one, because unless it's a hot coffee or a hot tea, I don't want any of my liquids to be lukewarm, dirty man milk water.
One lapping. So if he would have lapped once, just gone once.
A tickle of the tongue, you're suggesting.
But he actually tongue punches the plug hole.
Yeah.
And takes a gut three or four slurps of the bath water. And we're not just talking man milk.
We're talking
flakes of shit that hang off of a man's hairy arse.
We're talking bum crease cave clingers.
We're talking last night's dinner whiff.
Yeah, we're talking the guinea fowl and poached salmon that he had in his three-course meal the night before.
You're right. It would be such a rich diet.
Maybe it was delicious. Maybe we're doing him a disservice.
What the hell is that thing they're eating after Felix dies?
Posh shepherd's pie, innit?
It looks awful.
I'd give it a bash.
But it's not formed. It's not like a lovely square with a few caratas next to it.
I think it's meant to look a bit rough because they're all going through grief. And the fact that they're still sitting and trying to tuck into whatever the hell that is.
I don't know what that was.
So formal.
I don't know what that was speaking to. Look, if your son dies and then you go for breakfast, look, all of you are trying to pretend he hasn't. That's just not true.
And so recent. It's maybe months and years down the line, you're trying to avoid reliving that tragedy. But the day after, you're not just going to pretend it's not there. Mm. Like Felix is going to bowl in and tuck into whatever that guinea fowl fuck pie was.
And why has he put two razor blades on the bath with Venetia?
Yes.
Why has he put two razor blades there?
Because he's lower class. He buys in bulk and those Bic razors... Those Bic razors were on sale in Asda. I don't know, man. Yeah, you're right. The more, I mean, that's the gift and the curse of doing a podcast, I guess, is you finally comb over everything. And the more I speak about this film, the more we're discussing it. I know it's not the masterpiece that many people are making it out to be. And I think you get blindsided. Me personally get blindsided that it's a little bit dark. It's a little bit murky. And I like those sort of films. I think I may be guilty of being a little bit blindsided because it fits into what I normally seek out in film. The dodgy peoples, the damaged psyche, all of that. There is lots of that in this film. But when you finally go over it, yes, it's... Maybe my rating changes upon the finish.
Maybe.
Yeah, another dislike is just that Saltburn made me feel saggy. I've mentioned already that I wasn't a fan of the scandalous sex scenarios, but the partying scenes, the soundtrack, and the insights into youthful living made me feel sentimental for the good old days and also feel really fucking old.
You looked better in 2006.
Well, I should fucking hope so.
Yeah.
I don't have the wealth of Clune to age like a fine wine. Yeah. I'm looking like a saggy ball bag now, which is a damn shame. And... the fact that we are closer to 50 than 20 doesn't feel right to say. We are closer to the parents' ages than the young adults, and that makes me feel strange inside because I still identify as young.
Yeah, but when you were 20, you know, you weren't rich and going to Oxford, mate.
No. When I was 20, I was eating pot noodles and...
Well, we were supermarket workers.
Yeah.
We got fun where we could.
Yeah, we take whatever we could get.
Whatever we could get.
Fucking pies.
Pie.
Final dislike, we mentioned it earlier, it's that predictable twist. Now, I enjoyed Saltburn, or at least I think I did until I started this fucking episode. But I did see the finale coming very early into the film. This is probably a result of me watching so many of these types of films, but I sniffed Oliver Quick's intentions early doors. And that did lessen the film for me because I was just waiting for it to happen. I also think that Saltburn is very overhyped, and as stated before, I know I'm older than probably the vast majority of people that adore this film. That being said, mentioned it already, it's just not the masterpiece that many people are making it out to be. And you know what? Talking through those dislikes, I'm going to drop my score down a little bit. I've done it. He's done it.
I don't despise it. I definitely enjoyed moments of it.
Yeah.
Like, for some reason, Emerald Fennell manages to capture, like I was saying in one of my likes, she captures something for me that's almost akin to deja vu. I was like, oh, I can really feel that summer air.
Yeah, it's interesting that kind of invigorated you and made you look on it with sort of rose-tinted spectacles and happy for nostalgia. And I went the other way and felt fucking sad because I'm old as shit now.
Yeah, yeah. I do. I think where I thought this film was going to go was that Oliver was envious. He coveted Felix's life and he wanted it. And I just thought Felix was actually, deep down we see him as this guy that's got it all, but he kills himself. I thought it was going to be him committing suicide and Oliver learning from his privilege, of Felix's privilege, that it didn't define happiness. It didn't equate to happiness. I think it would have been a better film if it was more that and less, I'm a secret mastermind, I'm Mr. Glass.
Yeah.
Like, the only thing missing was a wheelchair and a purple coat.
Yeah. Yeah, I see what you says. And I think I've been heavily swayed by your persuasive arguments in this film. But you're right. First time I watched it, it's that shock. That's what settles. That's what you remember the film for. And the second time, you know it's coming, so it's not as impactful. And I watched it again. And there's moments in the film that makes me laugh. I like Barry Keoghan. As I say, I liked all the cast. I liked all their work in it. But the more you think about it, I think you can almost be sort of pigeonholed to thinking that it's a lot better than it is because of how popular it is at the moment.
Yeah.
It's sort of being rammed down my throat. I'm sort of being made to gargle that cummy water.
Ugh.
And like rub my belly and go, that's nummy.
Oh, nummy.
But it ain't nummy.
No, not really.
No. It's just a shame.
Yeah.
I've got some questions. Which actor's bathwater would you sup on if you had to?
Austin Butler.
Okay.
Because it has to be a man, doesn't it?
Doesn't have to.
Did you say jizz?
No, I just said bathwater, bro.
Oh,
fuck. I just said bathwater.
Well, I'll stick with Butler, because if I say some really good-looking actor, I'll be a misogynist objectifying women. I'll stick to the Butler.
Well, then, just to cover all fields, I'll be the misogynistic one.
Go on in.
And if I had to sup on some actor's bathwater...
Miriam Margolis.
Oh, that's top five worst.
That's human soup.
That is 50-year-old cabbage water.
Nah.
I'd go Margot Robbie. Number one, because she's beautiful. Number two, I just think she's a very clean individual. And as someone who's a bit of a germaphobe, I think that if I had to drink someone's dirty water, I think hers, compared to a lot of other people, would be all right.
But you're making an assumption, because her exterior is pleasing to the eye, that her interior is clean.
Yeah, but okay, I'm making an assumption that Miriam Margolis's bathwater is going to be a bit more clammy than Margot Robbie's.
Clammy.
But if I had to choose one, it's a ridiculous question like I like to throw out in this podcast. I'd go Robbie because,
no,
to me, she seems clean.
No,
right?
No, be honest, it's not because of that. It's because just like Keoghan in it, it would be a sexually gratifying.
Yeah, but I can safely say... I wouldn't go and spend money to drink her bathwater. I wouldn't drink any bathwater. I'm saying if I had to, she would be the actor I chose because I find her attractive.
And I'm saying if this microphone was off, you'd be saying, I would lap that up.
But then you have to be honest with yourself and knowing the germaphobe that I am.
Yeah, that's true.
I wouldn't be drinking bathwater.
I don't think you would.
No.
No, there'd have to be some sort of give and take. If Margot Robbie said, if you drink that bathwater...
Oh, I'm doing it.
There you go.
You don't even need to finish that
sentence.
The
only thing that was missing was a connective word, if.
Yeah, yeah, there we go. Which director's home would you like to infiltrate to become part of their everyday life?
James Cameron's, because he has a sprawling farm in New Zealand. And he bought it for like $18 million.
Oh.
And it's now what he considers his home. But I love New Zealand. It's one of the most beautiful countries I've ever been to. Love the people. And it's Cameron, you know. Guy has created some of the best blockbusters ever. I'm not saying he's perfect, but he has created some exceptional films. And I just think his house would be interesting, be fun.
I'd love to be chummy with Cameron.
Yeah.
Definitely. That's a great answer.
Yeah.
I'd go with Uncle Quentin Tarantino. I'd have to, because I imagine it would never happen, but me and him would be running around like Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly and Step Brothers, just like geeking out over the films, chasing each other with films.
Well, it would be lovely. His security would be chasing you.
Yeah, I'd probably be asked to leave almost immediately as soon as I started sort of grilling him for questions, for answers.
What sort of paraphernalia do you think you could find in Tarantino's house?
Foot stuff. Man likes a foot.
Yeah.
Lots of movie shit, which isn't... I reckon he probably dabbles in top-tier weed.
Yeah. He definitely... I think Tarantino doesn't watch porn to get his rocks off. I think he watches it for the technical, for the storytelling, for the framing of a shot.
Reckon.
I think he loves film that much that he can watch a porno and not pitch the tent.
He's watching Debbie Does Dallas for the scenery.
For the scenery and the dialogue.
Yeah.
100.
Yeah. I mean, that's enough for me to want to infiltrate his home.
Mm-hmm.
And cozy on down with Quentin. Barry Keoghan has a bright future ahead of him and has already amassed an impressive backlog of work.
No.
What are your top three Barry performances? You're not a Barry fan?
I am a Barry fan. I think he's taken the wrong path.
Okay.
I mean, this is nothing to do with being... I personally believe the way he's turning up to award events, you know, in sparkling outfits and stuff, it's weird. It's like... I want to know you as an actor. Now you're on Vogue with none of your clothes on. And it's kind of like, you're going to become something else now.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. Every actor is presented with a crossroads and they can go the Daniel Day-Lewis of staying out of the spotlight, or they can go into A-list superstardom where you see them, like you say, on Vanity Fair, turning up to events with outrageous clothes a la Jared Leto. And Barry seems to be taking that popular route, which is a shame because I think there is a raw talent there.
Yeah, I mean, Banshees will always be my favourite of his until obviously I see something else. First time I ever saw Barry Keoghan was in Dunkirk.
Mm.
And it was only a small supporting role, but I thought he's a very peculiar, handsome-looking person, which is odd because I didn't know you could have both.
I see what you're saying.
Like, yeah. He has a very distinct face, and it's not a face I ever thought Hollywood would want, ever. And that's not to be cruel. I'm not saying he's ugly. I don't think he is. I think he's actually really good-looking, and he's in great shape.
He's peculiar.
He's
got a unique look. I would say he could play a younger Joel Edgerton, or Joel Edgerton could play his dad. They've got a very similar look, and they're not necessarily what you would think would be your stereotypical good looks, but there's definitely a good look there. They're good looking. They've got a decent face structure.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'd say.
Masters of the Air.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and he has a short role in it. I think he's in it for 3 episodes, but I liked him in it. I sort of believed him, even though he's quite short and he looks really young. He still managed to pull off what was probably a 24, 25-year-old pilot of B-17. Yeah.
I think that the best of Barry is still to come if, like you say, he stays on the right trajectory. If he's not careful, he's going to be churning out rom-coms, franchise films, just because he's a big name. If he's not careful, he could go that way.
Could especially be a godsend that he didn't get the Batman scene.
Well, rumours have it he's going to be in the second one. So it's a matter of time with that. And I'd be interested to see it. I'll watch it, but I don't know. For me, he's top three roles. Banshees of Inisherin's head and shoulders of everything else,
mm-hmm.
like you say. Yeah. And Calm with Horses and The Killing of a Sacred Deer. Like you said, his role in The Killing of a Sacred Deer is basically his role in Saltburn.
Yeah.
But
infiltrate and destroy a family.
Exactly. But doing that 10 years ago and still giving his finest shifty Barry, I still liked it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. What would you rate Saltburn out of 10?
5.5.
All right. I was expecting round about that mark.
Yeah. I did enjoy aspects of it.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Not my coup of tea.
No, I mean, I must admit, I had it higher than the score I've ended up giving it. But through discussing it with you, it did drop, because I couldn't say all those things and then smash out that it was a 7.5. It was never that high. For me, I had it at a 6.5. But the more I spoke about it, I sort of had that realization that it's probably a bit less. So I've gone a 6.
Hmm.
There were still things I enjoyed about it, mainly the performances and sort of that sort of look into a damaged psyche, all that stuff that I always love in films. So I'd gone a little bit higher, but not by too much. That gives Saltburn a total score of 11.5 out of 20. If you like your dramas to be dark, deranged, and undoubtedly disturbed, or if you have ever wanted to see a questionable Keoghan slurp some soapy seed and suck on some sisterly bleed, then Saltburn could be a film for you. Saltburn is available to stream on Amazon Prime. Consider watching this one if you enjoyed Promising Young Woman, The Talented Mr. Ripley, and Parasite. Should we play a game?
Give it a name, give it a name, give it a name now. We birth a plot and then make a trailer. What the plot?
Action!
Y'all ready for this?
Oh.
An outcast and bullied dyslexic child accidentally writes his Christmas present wish list to Satan instead of Santa.
Ooh, and does Satan exist?
This letter somehow reaches the head honcho of hell, and Satan is touched by the thought of doing something nice for a change. Feeling festive and deciding to go against his usual evil dealings, Satan goes out of his way to deliver everything the child wants and more. In a bizarre turn of events, the Lord of Darkness befriends the child and the two become inseparable.
What?
That's it.
No, I heard it. That's cool. So Satan becomes friends with...
Yeah, but it's your classic, a bully dyslexic child writes his Christmas list to Satan because of a spelling mistake instead of Santa.
How old is this kid?
Young enough to be writing wish lists to Satan instead of Santa.
Hmm, okay.
So I see the casting. It would just be a talented child. I don't have anyone in mind to a 7 or 8 year old actor that would be amazing for this specific role. For me, the only casting comes in the form of Satan, who oddly has a heart that wants to... Just imagine you're like the chief of hell and someone's like asking you for something instead of begging you not to do something.
That's strange, isn't it? Because why would he all of a sudden have a nice bone in him?
Well, I'm putting it down to the fact that that's the first time he's ever got like a letter like asking him for something. And he's like, you know what? Yeah. I'm going to do it for you, kid.
Wait, was the letter initially intended for who?
It's initially intended for Santa, but because the child has dyslexia, he wrote it to Satan.
That's amazing.
So I see it as like a seasonal festive comedy that where this kid's who having a bit, kind of like Bad Santa, but with Satan. Like, not Bad Santa, but
Bad
good
Satan.
But good Satan.
Fucking hell, I don't know who would direct that, though, or who would want to. As funny as it sounds, that's this very particular type of comedy.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it could herald back to the sort of glory days of the early to mid-2000s. Like, no, not that, not him.
Well, it sounds like it could be that.
Like
a silly
Nicky,
voiced Satan.
I suppose, yeah. But I see the Satan as being someone who's like a lot more charismatic, maybe like good-looking, charming, but also menacing. And I was like the sort of comedy of Anchorman or that sort of slapstick humor where you fall in love with characters, that really old school sort of American comedies, how I envisioned it, but you can go any which way you like, obviously.
So it's and the subtext is sort of there's consequences to being dyslexic.
No, it's like, well, I guess you could look at it like that, but I'm just it's just a innocent funny plot that I can imagine like writing a letter intended for Santa, and it goes to who you think's the worst possible receiver of a letter, and he turns out to be so chill because he's never had anyone being like asking something nice of him.
Yeah, because he would be the first. This kid would have been the first to accidentally send a letter to Satan about what he wants for Christmas.
Yeah, and like the admin team in hell would be like, "This clearly isn't for you." Like. You don't give people gifts, you give people hell.
The admin team in hell.
The admin team, yeah.
That would be an interesting story.
Yeah.
An admin team in hell.
But that sort of, it could be a high concept comedy where Satan exists, hell exists, and like you see a good side of the devil, if that's even fucking possible.
Jesus.
But just, yeah, just mad oddball.
That's cool. Yeah, comedy. It could be funny. Could be funny to just, I mean, they do it a lot now. What's the one with Martin Sheen?
Good
series,
Omens.
Good Omens. Yeah. They're doing a lot of that now, where you can potentially see the good side to someone, to the devil.
Mm.
Does appear in a lot of things, like American Gods as well. Yeah. Oh God, it's a tough one. I'm gonna have to just come up with stuff. I'd have Ben Stiller direct.
Why not?
Because he does like he does still enjoy his over-the-top comedies. I think he could smash it. I think it would be funny. I'll make Bo Burnham the devil.
I tell you what.
Because he can sing and he's got a... I think he could play an eccentric character like that.
I tell you what, that is a, I did not see that going that way, but I could see that. That would be...
Well, you remember in his documentary Inside when he's like sweat hugging the wall and stuff, like he's bored, like he's stuck in a place and he can't leave it and nothing interests him, so he ends up making these piss take songs. I can imagine him being a bored devil sitting on his throne, like touching his beard, just watching an episode of Seinfeld.
And then a letter comes
through the door.
I tell you what, having him at the helm, you could even make this like a musical comedy with him doing some mega belting tunes as Satan.
Yeah.
Like, I'd really like to see that. That's a great casting choice, actually. I would never have thought you'd gone that way.
Yeah.
But I really like that.
And maybe he cures the kid's dyslexia but takes his legs.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, he's the fucking devil.
Yeah, give and take.
So he can't be all sweet and sugary. There's got to be some sour in there.
Yeah. Maybe he takes that kid on a road trip, comes down to Earth, just wants to get a bit of time with him, takes him on the road, and then, like, for some reason, the kid starts laughing at the dark shit the devil's doing. Like, setting fire to someone while they're filling up my car with petrol, and then goes, and the kid laughs, and they drive off and high five.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It could be like the son Satan never had, and they form a bond. But, yeah, I like that. I like what you've done with
that's
the
cool,
idea.
Yeah. It crossed his genres, didn't it?
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy. Title, fuck's sake. Oh, for fuck's sake.
It's all right, you can edit out any dead
air.
No,
I like it. Why am I struggling so much with this one? Like, you've done madder. I've done madder.
Man, I've been right there with you, where I can do the casting and the director and the title just doesn't strike me. Or equally, I can come up with a title when sitting there with no idea for the cast or the director. So it happens. I feels you. I did it for the whole of first season. I feels you big time. It's hard.
I know what I'd call it. Proofread.
Dear Satan, the kids at my school have been really mean to me this year. All I want for Christmas is a friend, but if I can't get that, I want a PS5. Hey, Gorloth the Destroyer, why am I getting a Christmas list? Does it look like it fucking snows down here?
This festive season, even the damned give a damn.
Okay, listen, kid. I'm getting bored of dishing out an eternity of hellfire to idiots that end up here. So just this once, I'm gonna do something nice.
From Ben Stiller, the face behind Zoolander and the mind behind Severance.
Right, you little fucks. You've been giving Timmy a hard time for not being able to spell. Guess what? Now you shitbags are gonna burn. Forever. Fuck you.
Give the gift that keeps on giving. Proofread. Coming soon. Starring Bo Burnham.